RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
As you can probably hear from the background noise, I'm by the sea on a gloriously sunny summer's afternoon here at Broadstairs in Kent, where I've travelled to meet today's guest, the graphic designer and typographer, Derek Birdsall. For 5 decades, he operated from London's Islington, producing a stream of beautiful work that adhered to his guiding modernist principles. But a few years back, he decided to permanently close the book on that aspect of his life. He now whiles away his time reading, sketching, following his sporting passion, cricket, or observing the comings and goings out to sea from his front room window, and always with a glass of chilled something close to hand. I first asked him why he had packed it all in.
I've given up. I gave up four or five years ago. It was very strange, because in our business, you know, you don't retire, everything like actors. You retire when the phone stops ringing. But I had this big job promise, big book on Peter Lanyon, and the guy ran and said, "Finally, Dad, it's ready." And I just said this was about 5 years ago. It was like a light switch went off. And I said, "You know, really, I'd ring John, my ex-assistant, John Morgan." I said, "Ring John." And it was a big book. It's 22 grand or something. Quite a job. And I suddenly got totally tired of other people's problems. And of course, graphic design is essentially other people's problem, or ought to be. We were well enough off, thank Christ. Also, I'd never known what it was like to be out of debt. When we sold our factory to my son, Jesse, we were out of debt for the first time in our lives. I had 180,000 overdraft when we sold that factory. We'd been in debt all our lives, partly through helping the kids, but partly just... I remember meeting Colin Forbes, who I sort of grew up with at Central. I remember coming down to, I think it was somewhere like Sheerness with him. His mother had died, and he'd come to sort out her out. And I remember him telling me he got 27,000, quite a lot of money in those days, 60, 62, 63. He said, "Do you know something, Derek?" He said, "I reckon I'm making more money out of my mother's house than I will ever make out of graphic design." And I think it was more or less true. But you do. I mean, I was pretty successful, but I never got past that sort of... I remember thinking at one time, I made about 10% more each year, which was comfortable.
Well, compared with today. Well, so you retired because you'd lost patience?
I suddenly realised that I didn't have to worry about other people's problems anymore. And on balance, I was willing to trade that for the pleasure, clearly, that one got out of designing. And once you, in graphic design anyway, once you've lost the parameter of other people's concerns, you don't have any...
No,
you've got to have a brief.
You've got to have a brief, otherwise we don't function.
You've got to have a brief, and you've got to have a deadline.
Well, look, what I'd like to do is I'd like to turn the pages back to your early life. You were born in 1934,
yeah,
just a couple of years before the Second World War, in Nottingley, near Pontefract, Yorkshire.
Yeah.
You had two brothers. What was it like back then?
We were not well off by any means, but it was a pleasurable existence. I mean, my father was taken off to an asylum when I was 11. That was quite a blow. But my mother, who was an amazing lady, she got the job of a caretaker of a little primary school, caretaking, and she sort of conned the local council into giving her the job on the basis she had two sons. I think I was by then 13, and my eldest brother was... Oh, my youngest brother was 10, I was 13. My eldest brother was 16. On the basis that she... It was supposed to go to a married couple, and she said, I don't need a husband, I've got all these boys.
Yep.
So, bless them, they gave her the job. So we had this quite delightful little cottage next to the primary school, which I'd been to. And there was playground, empty all weekend, we had mates around, quite pleasant. And though we were poor, I don't ever remember being hungry. I don't ever remember being unhappy.
Well, you were obviously bright because you to grammar school, so you must have passed your 11 plus.
I honestly think I partly got into grammar school by fraud. At the start of the... My grandfather had a copper plate, a writing book, which he used to let me read, look at. Copper plate writing. So that's when I first found a fondness for lettering, ornate lettering in those days. And I remember quite clearly. I broke my nibs, all pen and ink in those days, at the beginning of the exam. And I could have a new nib piece. So I got a brand new nib. You have to suck the wax off. And I wrote copper plate handwriting. I mean, I can remember now. It was beautifully written, my exam paper. Really? And I'm sure that was well on the way to getting a good mark.
I was going to ask you, you know, with so many designers that I've met and interviewed over the years, there was all this natural ability to express themselves visually, drawing. Yeah. Was that the same with you?
Yeah, I could draw. I could draw quite well. But when I got to art school, I was probably the worst drawer in the class. You know,
cause, really? Compared?
Well, they're the whole of Yorkshire to choose from. And I'd from one village, 10,000 people. Small town. And you suddenly turn from being Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo to, you know...
You eventually went to Wakefield College of Art, and there you were taught calligraphy, lettering, clay, modelling, history of architecture. You also...
Nine subjects you had to do for the intermediate.
And I gather that one of your fellow students there was David Story, the writer. And this has interested me. You're only 15-ish around there. It's, I read in your own book that you bought an Adana flatbed printing machine with type. Really? That's
a bit. It was £5. And my mother contributed. And it was a machine they'd used in the shop for doing price tickets. And they didn't want it. And it was the answer in the window. It was a very primitive machine. It was the roller pulled across without any tension. So the inking was dreadful. But it was a printing machine.
Nevertheless, you at that young age, you were fascinated by...
Well, that was partly because in Wakefield, there was a printing department for composite. The unions were still strong in those days, and the art students weren't allowed anywhere near it. But there was this big room, and I used to sit... And we used to have our lettering classes in there. Sign writing classes, actually, not lettering, sign writing.
I know.
And we were surrounded by all these rows of drawers. Fascinated. And when I got this printing press, I used to sneak into that room and stick for job. I did jobs for local ice cream, R.J. Lewis, I remember. And I went and I pinched R.J. Lewis. There was that 72-point Gill out of the nearest case to the door. Gill was the nearest case to the door. That's one of the ways I got my love of Gill. It was nearest case.
So it was there that you just... Of course, because it was convenient.
years later at the Central, Jesse Collins.
This is when you were around 18, 52.
Yeah.
You moved to London.
Yeah.
So that was a big thing, moving to London. How did you find that, the move to London? I mean,
That was pretty traumatic, because in those days, there was never any question of them finding accommodation. It turned up day one, and you were supposed to find somewhere yourself. Pretty bad. I wouldn't want to put students through that again. Found a B&B, would you believe, in Bloomsbury Street, first night. Then the next day, I heard about a hostel in Rosby Avenue. God. So I got in there for 6 years.
So really, in what very is now a very fashionable area.
Oh, yeah, of course. Short walk to the Central.
Interestingly, I mean, you were at Central under tuition of Jesse Collins at a time when I know Anthony Froshard was there too, and you were taught for a while by him. Yeah. But interestingly, because I, you know, several years ago when it was the anniversary of the graphics to the Royal College, I was asked, would I write an essay about 1948 to 1960, because for some reason nobody seemed to know. Anyway, so I researched and I spoke to a lot of people, including Dennis Bailey and David Gentleman, who were there straight after the war. And what I was amazed by was that all of the MA students that went, you know, the postgraduate students that went to the Royal College at the time, were all incredibly disappointed by the tuition they were getting at the Royal College, having come from Central, where it was much more exciting. Yeah. Typography was more dynamic.
Yeah, the college had this laissez-faire attitude. It's true, the college at the Central was quite disciplined in a friendly way. I remember at one point I was depressed about it, and Jesse Collins got hold of me. You know that front hall in the Central? A bit like a church. And we stood looking at Kingsway, and trams were going by in those
days.
And he said, Derek, he had a booming Welsh voice, not unlike Dylan Thomas, actually. He said, Derek, out there are the barbarians. This is a chapel of good taste. Very good.
You stayed there, and in fact, while you were there, when you were only 19, you married Shirley, your wife. I mean, that was quite a thing, you know, when students were...
Well, she got pregnant for a start, and in those days...
And also in those days, in the 50s...
But she'd moved down 6 months earlier.
Right. That was the norm then. People got married when they were 18 or 19.
Oh, yeah. Well, people did everything when they were... I mean, Turner went to the Royal Academy School when he was 14.
Yeah.
You know, everything
different.
That has caused me to think quite a lot of the period. No, everything happened. 15 was not unusual to make your mark in those days.
Then, of course, came the inevitable, which is National Service, which you know, so many people I've spoken to, you know, had to endure the National Service. And the stories are always very funny. Now, from what I understand, you were assigned to the printing unit.
Yeah.
You also met Ross Kramer, who was at Saatchi later, and, of course,
and
Terence Donovan.
We were in the same unit.
So you both, I mean, all of, sorry, I don't know whether you all went, but you were posted to Cyprus.
That's right. Me and Ross Kramer.
Okay, where there was very little in the print department because there was nothing.
No, well, they just pulled out. At that point, Suez took place, and it was chaos. That's why the printing department never occurred.
So what did you do?
I think it was Ross's idea. We were all really disgruntled. We mercifully weren't given any heavy tasks, or so. We were in the ordnance anyway, that was the printing unit.
So that was really, you didn't...
I can't say I had a bad National Service, except for being separated from...
Which is, yes. Which,
Shirley and our youngest son.
And your son.
Today, I don't think it would happen.
So you eventually return back to Civvy Street, and you meet up with John Commander, who was the managing director of Boarding and Mansell.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he offered you a part-time...
Miracle day.
Job.
No, not quite.
Not quite.
No, I wrote to a few people, as you did in those days. Printers were quite a big source of freelance work for designers in those days. Because clients didn't know about design. They'd just say, well, could you produce this for me to the printer?
Yeah.
So the printer had to get a design done. And of course, printers historically had been designers anyway. So I wrote to a few people. Philip Thompson, who'd been a mentor of mine at Central, got me an interview with Tom Woolsey. At Crawford's.
Town Magazine.
And I got offered a... Well, he was at Crawford's
yes,
then.
Yes, of course.
I got offered a job as a typographer. Because in those days, typographers did the type on ads. Specialised. And I got a job offer there at £8 a week. The same week, I went to see John Commander, who I took to... He took to me straight away. I don't know, young lad from York. And he offered me... Decca had just brought out boxed opera sets. Velpies, and they had a little book to go with them. And the printer had been expected to get these. And he asked me if I'd do two of them, four guineas each. In those days, it was all guineas, you remember. And my brain snapped, and I did them overnight. I went straight home, did them. I delayed a day, I was cunning. I didn't ring John up the next day and say, I've done them. I waited a day, and he was very impressed and liked them. And they were great, very successful. I went on to do several. But I suddenly realised that if I could earn eight guineas, in an evening, that was a lot better than £8 a week. So, with Shirley's blessing, thank Christ, I never took a job. Never had a job since. It's just that Yorkshire economics. You know?
Yeah, of course. We also, I think, you did the occasional teaching slot at Central.
That was a bit later. I did... my first teaching was at
London School of Printing.
Yeah, as it was in those days in Clerkenwell.
And then, of course, I think with Balding and Mansell, they gave you a little... Base. There were a whole group of you. There was George Mayhew.
About that time, George Dalby, George Mayhew, Peter Wilber, and me.
Yes.
Who knew each other from the Central.
Yeah.
George had taught me, actually, George Mayhew.
Yeah.
Got the idea of forming a group. And John offered us their loft, which wasn't being used, top floor, Bloomsbury Place. And so we started this group.
And it was a sort of super group, really, if I think about it. At the time, because...
Well, we were sort of, I guess, top equal with... Fletcher Forbes came a year or two later. Fletcher was then previously in partnership with the same Peter Wilber and Arrow Bertram, FWB partnership.
I think if you think about the period, which, I mean, you all sort of surfaced at a really exciting time in this country, particularly, when, if you think that everything was changing, almost every creative era, film... Theatre, photography, art, music,
but of course,
architecture.
You didn't know that. I
mean, it was just,
it seemed so natural.
Yeah, I mean, it became recognised by the rest of the world very quickly, America particularly.
And of course, in those days, the numbers were very small. I mean, the number of graphic designers that could be named by any would probably be Henrion, Games, Eckersley, Levitt Him, and then you struggle.
Exactly. And that is the...
The next year, we were, I suppose, the next generation were one. We were... there were only a dozen or 15 of us.
I always think of you and Fletcher and that little tight-knit group as the ones that were pushing the edges out, you know, because you've mentioned Abraham Games and so forth, and they, although they were very well-known, their work was still rooted in a sort of earlier period.
Very English.
It was centred type.
Schlegel was the one that... bridged the gap. He was international.
Yes.
And I used to revere. We revered Schlegel's work. and Philip and I particularly.
And Tischold, of course, had converted over to classicism and
he'd gone the other way.
He'd sort of suddenly decided that modernism was actually, well, maybe he was just bored, because he was one of the pioneers.
Yeah, my own, I don't remember, I mean, I remember knowing that we were modernists. I mean, I remember knowing that Anthony was very influenced by Chico. I've learned more of that since. And of course, I was very influenced by Anthony,
yeah,
who, among most things, taught me, hated woolly thinking. You
know? Yes.
He taught one to think, which of course is what university is supposed to do,
yeah,
to think. And I was able to turn thinking into typography.
Yes.
You know, there's a kind of natural link with text, yeah, thinking, type markup, visualization.
And also, you, which you've maintained, I mean, okay, you told me at the beginning now you've retired, but throughout your career, you had, it seemed to me, honed in on a group of typefaces that meant a lot to you, because this is my own theory, that they'd served their apprenticeship. They were great typefaces. They had their own
and
emotional dimension.
And you learned how to use them.
Yes.
And you learned that it wasn't clever to use a typeface you weren't used to.
Yeah.
Until you developed each typeface needed a certain kind of care and attention.
Yeah.
And you can't just pick up a type book, choose a type. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
And having an affinity with the type anyway,
yeah,
which I'd had from central school, because I have to confess, most of my affinity for my early types was the central school composing room,
yeah,
which also you weren't allowed into, but I got into. You know, they had Valbaum, an extraordinary type, wonderful type, which I'd never seen before. They had Polyphilus,
yeah,
which I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
So a lot of my early loves for type were based on what I saw and was able to... You were able to get work done in the comp room, but you couldn't go... You'd give a layout and they'd set it.
Is this because of union?
Yeah,
it was union. The union. They were very tight.
I did my thesis on the history of the central school. The unions had the chance of absorbing graphic designers, or typographers, or whatever, call them what you were,
yeah,
in 1912. Or 1914, and they turned them down. So I remember saying that all that time was wasted when designers could have been part of the industry, you know, which they later became. Mm. Spencer.
Yeah.
And us through Balding and Mansfield.
Yeah.
And later Western.
While you were with your little cohort of designers with your own group, you established, you'd obviously thought carefully about actually promoting graphic designers.
Oh, yeah.
London-based graphic designers that were like-minded.
Yeah.
And so out of that came 17 Graphic Designers London, which is actually a very important book. It's very important because it was a forerunner, really, to DNAD.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, John Commander was the first president of DNAD. And when I look at that book now, and I look at the first DNAD annual, the same people are in it. Okay, yeah. They're advertising people. The graphic people were very
evident. And the work stands up quite well.
I have all DNAD annuals, and the very first one I actually bought, I remember, it was a lot of money, the black and white one with the apples. And I look through it even now, today, and I get excited by it. And it's just in black and white.
Yeah,
that's the weird thing. It's in black and white, you look through it and you get excited.
Well, it is. That's interesting in itself, you see, because I remember seeing Paul Wren's work for the first time in Thoughts on Design in the Central Library.
Yes.
The Central had a brilliant librarian.
Yeah.
He got Print Magazine, he got TM. I mean, can you believe that?
Yeah.
He got TM in 1952.
Yeah. Wow.
And he got Paul Wren's book. No, Paul Wren's book was all in black and white.
Yes.
But it translated.
Yeah.
You didn't need the cut.
No, you didn't. It's almost like black and white films.
Yeah.
If they're good.
And black and white photography.
They work. They're special. No, I agree with that. I think, you know, seeing things in black and white is a very good...
Somebody should do a thing on that one. It is a strange paradox that colour was a kind of icing. You don't need colour.
Yeah.
You don't actually need it. I was doing some layouts for a book by Frank Auerbach. And he came out studio and I had all these black and white prints. And he said, I wish I could paint like that. They were black and white prints of his own paintings.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, I always think that actually when designers, graphic designers, are restricted, when a client says, we haven't got them, this is not so much now, back in the 60s and 70s, they'd say, we can only afford two colours. And you think, great.
Two colours.
Because basically it concentrates your mind and it makes you more inventive.
Of course it does.
These days you can have as much colour as you want.
Some of the most brilliant exercises we did, I think they came from the continent. You had to design an invitation card, same copy. You had to design it three times. One all the same size of type, one all in the same type, one in the same size of type, one using bold and one using colour. Well, what a brilliant exercise.
Yeah, still should be the sort of thing that...
Of course, of course.
I mean, everyone's got the whole box of tricks now.
You can't do that.
I agree, I'm
and having learned to do that, you learn parsimony, you learn to be very careful. I remember learning... I still have a hatred of italic capitals. Because
it's annoying.
Capital, what do you need italic for?
I know.
If you've got capitals.
Yeah. Your early work, as along with so many of your contemporaries, Penguin was a big source.
Oh, yes.
And
they were.
I remember Alan Fletcher telling me when I interviewed him a long time ago that between the three of them, Fletcher Ford, they used to argue who was going to do the
next Penguin.
Because it would come in and they'd all argue about it. And you did a lot of work for Penguin. I mean, you were working for Penguin from the late 50s right through to the 70s.
Yeah. Well, again, John Curtis, who came to see me, took a shine to me. We got on very well. I did good work for him. And then later, David Pelham and I struck up a relationship.
Did you ever work with Germano Fischetti?
Only once. I can't remember what it was now. But Germano was a bit like... He was a great supporter of Romek Marber.
Yes.
You see, so that was he was his baby.
Yeah.
And Romek and Marber reminded me, which I didn't know. He and I did competing grids for that. I didn't realise I'd done a grid.
I didn't know that. That's an interesting... I'd love to see what you produce.
So would I.
It's probably in the archive of Penguin, I should think. That would be a very interesting thing to see.
Well, if you ever find it, I'd love to see it.
Well, I'll check that out. You also, of course, you worked on the second Pirelli calendar.
Yeah.
And glamorously, instead of, like Fletcher Forbes and Gill, shooting in Hyde Park, you went off to Morris.
Well, that was Robert...
Freeman?
Freeman.
Yeah.
Robert Freeman's idea.
Yeah.
He took my breath away and he took Pirelli's breath away.
Yeah.
He said, May... You can't shoot in England in March. Could they be done in March? No, we'll go to Mallorca. Shirley came. Simon, our second son, or Jesse, 3 months earlier. And I thought it's a marvellous opportunity for Shirley to get away. So Pirelli agreed. Pirelli, they were brilliant. Rented a villa, sort of three models. And we had a well of a time. But that was Robert. And he was the Beatles photographer.
So. Yes, I know.
And this is my naivety in those. I rang Colin. And I said, they've given me the cut. He said, yeah, I know. I said, can you recommend a photographer? He said, well, the guy just done our picture, like the Beatles. The one of Fletcher Ford and Gill in Polonic Sweaters, which is a copy of a Beatles cover. I said, ask him. So I rang Robert. Robert and I got on very well. Robert had been a bit of a graphic designer in his university days, was very knowledgeable. And it was him who came up with the astonishing idea of going to Mallorca. Then became known.
You can't arrive Park.
In March in England.
Well, that obviously turned into a phenomenon because, you know, I think it stopped. I don't know if they still do it. It was a big gap and then they reintroduced it.
I don't know whether they still do it or not.
Moving on, you after the Pirelli, you got this incredible project. Which it lasted for 20 years, which was the Mobile Pegasus magazine.
Yeah.
And you art directed other magazines also.
Briefly, yeah.
You art directed Town before Dennis Bailey joined them, and Twen.
I kept the seat warm for David.
Yes.
For Tom. And Dennis had got the job.
Yeah.
He couldn't come.
He was in Paris.
6 months, so I kept his seat warm.
And you were invited to Twen to do a spot
6 months.
There. And then, of course, Nova.
Yeah.
After Harry Pacinotti.
That's right. Well, to my eternal shame, Dennis Hackett, who I'd worked with as a copywriter.
Yes.
Rang me up one day and said, I'm going to fire Pacinotti. If I do, will you take over for a few months till I get somebody else? And I regret that. I should have rung Harry, actually, but I didn't. But, of course, then Harry and I became great friends.
Yes.
It was a great moment for Harry.
Yeah.
Because having been fired from the magazine as art director...
He became the photographer.
He became the Nova
brilliant
photographer. Working with him, Molly and me.
Yeah.
And, I mean, brilliant. I mean, actually, brilliant photographer.
I remember when Nova...
That made him.
Yes. I remember Nova appearing, and it was before Nova.
It has to be said, he wasn't a bad art director either.
No, no, I was going to say, the thing about editorial design, putting town to one side and Wolsey and so forth, but you would look to Twen. You'd go to the old Compton Street.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Continental news agent and buy it. And then suddenly Nova appeared, and it was our Twen.
Yeah. You know, there's a nice story about Twen. It was done by a couple of copywriters, and they got Willie Fleckhouse to do the design, and they took the dummy around to raise money.
Mm.
And they finally got some money, and they printed the dummy. There was a stupid article. Ubo Voost, I think his name was, who I worked with later at the magazine, said they're stupid articles.
Yes.
Just put in for fun, you know, for a dummy.
Yeah.
They printed them.
Yeah. I bought it. Of course, couldn't speak German at all. It's a visual feast.
Oh, of course it was.
You looked at the...
It was a wonderful combination of Swiss typography and mad design.
Yeah, and Heinz Endelmann's illustrations and Hans Fuhrer.
Absolutely.
You know, so many great...
And it's from Willy. I got this great quote. He admired a layout he'd done for an article on Yves Montand. And the opening spread was an actual size hand with a gitane. You could see the gitane logo, cigarette. And above it, it just said Yves. That alone.
Yeah.
But that was double spread opening.
Yeah.
And I remember, and I said to him, that was, he said, well, I said, Derek, I learn. If you get bad pictures, you make them very larger. If you get unusable pictures, make them even larger. And he just found this hand.
The layouts in... Twen, looking at them now.
Oh,
are
absolutely.
Fantastic.
And the gravure.
Yes, absolutely.
The quality of that gravure.
The black is, you know, sort of wonderful. Well, moving on, you eventually parted company with all your buddies and you set up in Covent Garden.
Yeah.
And you joined forces with Derek Forsyth, who was the manager.
He was the advertising manager
for Pirelli, yes. And I think, from what I understand, you eventually felt that you were more or less being forced into a kind of a manager almost, rather than doing what you wanted, hands on.
And he started taking a great interest in design and commissioning design, getting the assistant to do, which I couldn't take. That was my other traitorist thing. When Forsyth asked me, leaving Pirelli, and he had the Pirelli account, would I join with? I said yes. Years later, I met Colin at his farewell party. And he said, whatever made you join with Forsyth? I said, greed.
Well, actually, on that point, you mentioned Colin Forbes, yes? That's who you were talking about. Is it true that you were approached by Fletcher Forbes?
When Gil left.
Yeah, to join them.
Yeah, when Gil left, Theo Crosby, who joined them there by then, Alan and Colin came to see me at Bloomsbury Place and asked me if I'd join them. And I'd just got this lease on this studio in Covent Garden with a flat above. Shirley and I were having our problems, and it was a great ask. I'm so relieved to this day I didn't take it. But I said, look, I've just got the studio in Covent Garden. I'm going to go on my own. I want to be on my own for a bit.
Yeah.
I like the idea of being on my own. I'm sorry, you know. So I didn't take them up. And I got a studio in Covent Garden.
Continue with the name Omnific, which...
No, I started, that's when I... We started Omnific with Forsyth.
With Forsyth.
And I kept that name, yeah.
And just for the listeners, Omnific, the meaning?
All creating.
Yes.
I decided that names beginning with O and Q were kind of smart. I don't know why. So I went through a dictionary looking through O and Q. Came across this, that, the other. And I saw Omnific, all creating. I thought, well.
A little later, when you were very much in control of your own destiny, you had two further partners. You had Alan Kitchen.
Yeah.
And you had Martin Lee.
Yeah.
Now, Martin Lee, interestingly, was a production manager. Yeah. And that was quite an interesting move, really. And, of course, Alan was very much typographer
at
that time. And books became your... really a large part of your work.
Yeah,
books became a staple.
Partly through Mobile.
Yeah.
Who started doing spin-off books. I started doing spin-off books for. And by then, I'd started working with West Press. And Martin worked at Western Press.
Mm.
He was their production director.
And Westrom at the time were the printer.
Well,
I remember,
yeah,
right. They were very...
Yeah, they were.
They were sympathetic to designers, yeah, and
exactly.
Understood.
They'd taken over the role of Balding Mansell, really.
And just moving on, a little later, you... I don't know whether it was a gap between Alan Kitchen leaving and coming back or what, I'm not quite sure, but Alan, you actually was instrumental in encouraging Alan to get more involved in letterpress.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got the idea that I'd like to have a letterpress set up. So I got Alan, I consulted with Alan, and we ordered a shitload of stuff from Stevenson Blake, who was still supplying it. That was founder's time.
They were in Fleet Street. I remember them well.
Futura, Valbo, all founder's time. And they had one or two proofing machines left. They were still selling letterpress to the Third World. It's ironic that one of the great beauties of printing was like little Third World. I bought a whole stock set, nice composing room, all brand new.
Mm.
Which was great to be able to do that, order from a catalogue. And after about a few months, Alan said he'd like to go on his own. I remember we'd started building a wall, my second son, started building a wall in the studio for Omnific, that side, and me, this side, because I was sort of on my own a bit. And the wall had got to about that high. And Alan said, I want to go on my own. And I almost hugged him. I knew what he meant, because he'd never been happy as a designer. He'd never been happy. You can't shovel shit uphill.
Yeah.
It was one of his great amounts. I almost hugged him and... ended up selling him all that cost. So you'd have the lot.
And I think whilst you were, for not a long time, but you were a lecturer at the Royal College, you encouraged them to take on Alan as the...
That's when I got the professorship.
Yes, exactly.
For a year.
Yeah.
And that's when Harry, the old letterpress guy, was retiring. And I persuaded him to stay on for 6 months until Alan... could take over.
Yeah.
And that was a great move, getting Alan.
Very good move. But actually, the side issue here that I'd be interested in, if you want to talk about it, but you were there as Professor Graphics, but it came to a sort of abrupt end due to a confrontation with Jocelyn Stevens. What actually happened?
Jocelyn, in one of those flights of fantasy that autocrats usually have, he said, Derek, how about in a big meeting, always intimidating, all the professors there. And Derek, I think we should start an art director's course. It was a big course, start courses, colonial. And to my eternal regret, I said, yeah, it's a possibility. I shouldn't have said no. So anyway, he then asked me to set it up, and I wrote a couple of quite good reports, one saying there should be two courses, one for advertising art directing and one for editorial art directing. Justin didn't see that at all. Didn't see the distinction. And at some point, I did this report, and at some point he called me. He said, this won't do. I said, what do I? He said, if you can't do it, I'll get somebody who will. Who can? And then he said, I've got to go. I've got to meet. He was always like that. So I sat there on my own in his office. So I went out. His secretary sat there. I said, do you hear that? She said, yeah, I did. I said, it's very serious, She said, I know it is. So I went back to talk to Alistair Grant, who had got me into college in the first place. I said, I wouldn't put up with a client talking to me like that. It's interesting, you have these milieus in which, and I mean, you would never allow a client to talk to you like that. I mean, you have several standards according to the situation. Wrote to himself, I'm leaving. I was sent to do it in a way, part mainly because of the students, but at the same time, it's sort of a bit of a relief. I probably shouldn't have done that job, although I was glad I got Martin in, and Alan, of course. Alan went on great success after that. He was a natural teacher.
Yes, and he's sort of grown
the printing workshop,
with that.
Yeah.
Now, the other aspect of your relationships with people, which I've always found interesting, is the connections with some illustrators. So, for example, Michael Foreman, who worked with you on Pegasus, but also with book covers like the Philip Roth covers and so forth. That's a nice thing. And also there's Philip Thompson, I think he's worked for you, and Ron Sanford, the other one. Is that because you rather like, you know, filmmakers, they have their cinematographer and their set designer, you felt that they understood you or you loved their work or what? How did it?
I think it's a bit different to that, eh? I knew very early on that there are certain things that illustration could do that photography can't, and vice versa, but not much vice versa. And so I began to get interested in illustration and realised that illustration can help you out on certain projects, certain magazine layouts and so on, in a way that photography couldn't. And anyway, the variety. And I befriended Michael and Ron, and I enjoyed the delivery of the work and the discussion of the work. And I remember ringing Philip once. I'd asked him to do a drawing for an architect on drawing board, redesigning Europe. That was my idea, and I'd rang Philip and asked, could you do something? So he sent me this rather tight drawing. It's good, but it was a bit tight. And I, as is often the case, I thought, well, maybe my brief, you know. So I rang him up and said, I hope you don't mind saying so. I said, it's a bit ordered, a bit tight, a bit, I'd like something a bit looser. He said, oh, I've got one of those. He went over the waste paper basket and said, I've got one, I'll send it to you. And he sent me this crumpled, straightened out, crumpled drawing. It's perfect.
Yeah, that's perfect. Interesting, because often those instantaneous sketches have got a quality that...
Absolutely.
And he certainly, I've always loved his... For me, he was a conceptual illustrator.
Yeah.
He had ideas. I mean, I always loved his stickers that he produced called Boring.
You
just stick them, stick them onto anything you find boring. And I thought, such a brilliant thing to do, particularly these days. There are so many boring things. One of the things you said to me in an interview way back 16 years ago was that the job of a designer was to make their clients happy. And you should never force things down their throats.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. Well, because, you know, there are a lot of designers who are kind of, that have this you're getting what you're given.
Oh, I won't name names, but there's one or two still. An open distaste for clients.
Yes.
I won't name the name, but clients that we are now living. I mean,
yeah.
And I've been accused of being a client's man. It's a accusation I accept proudly.
Mm.
Because I could see a client. I had one or two instances, because I seemed to have a way with myself, of persuading a client to take a job he patently didn't like. And I just kicked myself out. It's not the right thing to do. You're never right to do that. It's the client's money, it's his work, it's his job. And I think, so I never got that. You carry the client with you. In fact, it's quite an art to make the client see things your way. That's not quite the same thing as making him take things he doesn't like.
Mm.
Describing the problem to him, whose problem it is, in such a way that it leads naturally to what you've done, is quite an art. Predisposing a client to something you've done is quite helpful. Because, of course, they're blind. They don't work in your milieu.
No.
They haven't been sweating over it for 3 weeks. So you must start at the beginning. Don't say, "Baylor, look at that," because they'll almost certainly not know what you're showing them. I mean, they haven't been part of the process. I remember doing a job. I can't remember the job now, but yellow was a strong ingredient, and the chairman said, "My wife hates yellow," and I thought, "Well, that's that." I mean, there's really no point. I said, "Well, it can be any colour you like." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." George Mayhew taught me that. He'd done in the days when he'd done a reception area for an advertising agency. And he'd done a red ceiling in the days when you did red ceilings. Don't like red ceiling. And George said, famously, "You can have any colour you like." Which is one of the most disarming. I used to say that about typefaces, not quite meaning.
No. Because you have
quite
a very...
Yeah.
See, as long as it's within this 12.
I used to say, yeah. But it always disarms them, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
I say, "You have any typeface you like, if you don't like that one." And George said, "You have any colour you like." And they said, "But you're the designer." To which he said yes, and I say red.
Now, actually, again, going back to the original interview, when I came to see you in 2002 at your house in Islington, you showed me a pile of layouts at the time on a book, and you called it, you said, this is a book I'm working on, and it's called The Intelligent Book. That was your working title. Of course, eventually became that your, really what has become a definitive book, Notes on Book Design, and, you know, to my mind, it's the best book on the subject, really, of graphic design, and in particular books, since the book that inspired me, which is Joseph Muller Brockman's The Graphic Designer and His Design Problems, which I found in the evening class library in the 60s that I went to. And for me, that your book should be a standard reading for more so these days, because I see so many terrible mistakes.
Glad and grateful to you.
I mean, it's really very good that you finally got that out, and it's
done.
It's there, and it's a standard work. Is there anything that you wish you'd done that you never got round to?
I would have loved to. John McConnell has been to see me a couple of times. He also has long affinities with Broad Stairs, it turns out.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. He's been to see me a couple of times. His daughter lives not very far away. And he started working with, he's still working, with the British Museum. And I remember saying to him, a job I really would have loved to have had would have been art director of the British Museum. You know, what a job that
would
be.
Yeah.
And he said, you'd hate it, he said.
Oh, dear.
The backstabs, the backstabbing, the departmental, all of which I can imagine.
Well, is there a project, one project that you would think that typifies what you believe in and what you're most happy with? What would you say is, for you, one of your best, if you had to look back?
Oh, the jobs I've done. Well, the prayer book was very rewarding, mainly because the client was so good. I mean, not good, receptive and cooperative and interested. And it fascinated me at how many of the clergy are interested in typography.
I guess because the Bible has always been interestingly typographically for some weird reason.
I remember meeting Michael Foote once, just not long before he died, actually. And he said, he was very profoundly deaf in those days then. What do you do? I'm a typographer, for want of a better word, you know. Oh, typography. Very interesting subject. Michael Foote.
Yeah. Well, if you think about all those Labour Party pamphlets and things.
Yeah.
Well, just for the listeners, what we were just talking about is the Church of England's prayer book.
Yeah.
And it also, interestingly, going right back to the beginning, the very typeface that you seconded on the way out of your...
Yeah.
Was Gill.
Yeah.
And that entire book is in Gill.
Yeah.
So that's a nice moment to... We're rounding up to the end now.
Yeah.
Just if you had to give advice to a young designer, graphic designer, starting out today, what advice would you give them?
Learn to do something well. I say that to all my friends' children. Learn to do something well. And then from that, other things will come. So, you know, learn to get type properly set. Learn to get the spacing. Learn something simple.
Mm.
Learn it well. Mm. Get good at it. And that'll give you confidence. Confidence is all.
Okay. Well, Derek Birtle, thank you very much.